Africa. Today is Monday, February 22nd, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington, filling in for Steve Miller for the next 2 weeks. Coming up, the latest on anti-coup protests in Myanmar.
Many peacefully gathered in the second biggest city, Mandalay, where soldiers opened fire on civilians Saturday and killed two people.
Also ahead, we hear from Ilyasa Shabazz, the daughter of Malcolm X.
He said that we all were going through the same thing no matter where we existed on Earth.
Plus, why Hong Kongers are leaving for London. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Myanmar, where thousands of opponents of the military coup gathered on Sunday across the country. They took to the streets despite Saturday being the bloodiest day yet since the February 1st push. Edward Barron of Reuters reports.
From the north of Myanmar to the south, thousands of people returned to the streets on Sunday to protest, a day after the bloodiest crackdown seen yet since the military coup almost 3 weeks ago. Many peacefully gathered in the second biggest city, Mandalay, the city where soldiers opened fire on civilians Saturday and killed two people. In Yangon, protesters like So Pang showed no sign of relenting. Instead, he joined the crowds, holding banners that read, "Reject military coup."
The military wants to stop us from coming out on the streets, so they strongly respond to us. We, the people, won't accept their unfair oppression, and we will continue to fight.
Earlier today, police arrested a famous actor for supporting the protests, while Facebook deleted the military's main page for inciting violence. Spokesman for the new military council, Zaw Min Tun, has not responded to attempts by Reuters to contact him.
That was Edward Barron of Reuters. COVID-19's impact on efforts to combat gross human rights violations will be a major focus of the 46th regular session of the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA on the session, which starts Monday in Geneva.
The four-week session will be held virtually because of the pandemic. It will kick off with a three-day high-level segment where nine heads of state and other dignitaries from more than 130 countries will address the UN Human Rights Council by video. UN officials say the vast majority of their statements are expected to focus on COVID-19. The pandemic also will be the theme of a special panel discussion Monday on the fight against racism and discrimination and its exacerbating effects on these efforts. Human Rights Watch Executive Director Kenneth Roth says the Council should examine how various governments have used the pandemic as a pretext to entrench their power by cracking down on the opposition. He cites the example of Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who seized power for a while to rule by decree without parliamentary legislation.
Another example was, the recent elections in Uganda, where President Museveni used the pandemic as a pretext to preclude campaigning by his main opponent, Bobi Wine. The repeated use of deadly violence, the arrest of people, the repeated arrests and actual beating of Bobi Wine, many of this just using the pandemic as a pretext.
Special panel discussions will be devoted to issues such as the death penalty, children's rights, and the rights of people with disabilities. The human rights records of numerous countries will come under Council scrutiny. A scathing report by UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet on Sri Lanka's failure to address past violations and impunity for grave human rights violations will be reviewed. Other highlights include the examination of Myanmar's military coup and continuing violations in countries such as Belarus, Venezuela, Iran, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Burundi, and North Korea. The list is long. UN and human rights activists welcome U.S. President Joe Biden's decision to rejoin the Council nearly 3 years after former President Donald Trump's administration quit the body. They say they hope the U.S. will use its muscle on the world stage to promote universal fundamental freedoms and the rule of law. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Australia began a mass COVID-19 vaccination program Sunday. A series of hard lockdowns and other public health measures has largely contained the spread of the coronavirus in Australia compared to other wealthy nations. But as vaccination efforts get underway, new research shows that more than 1 in 5 people in Australia say they probably or definitely will not get a vaccine. That's despite the fact that numerous vaccines against the coronavirus have been shown to be both safe and effective in preventing severe illness and death from COVID-19. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In multicultural Australia, the government is urging minority groups to receive a coronavirus vaccine. However, public health campaigns don't always work or reach their intended audience. The result is that there can be suspicion or ignorance of the inoculation process in migrant communities. New research from the Australian National University has found similar reservations among many women, Indigenous people, and those with less education. Professor Nicholas Biddle is the study's co-author.
There was a very large increase in the proportion of Australians who said they probably wouldn't or definitely wouldn't get a vaccine, from about 12.5% in August to about 21.5% in January 2021.
Biddle believes low rates of COVID-19 in Australia have given some groups a false sense of security.
The fact that Australia has had relatively low rates of infection and very low rates of mortality might mean that people are somewhat complacent and don't see the vaccine as being necessary. What we need to do is remind people that A, the vaccine's effective, B, that it's been tested so it's safe. It's only with a vaccine that your life can return to some form of normalcy.
Two drugs developed by Pfizer and AstraZeneca have been approved for use in Australia, where a mass inoculation program started Sunday. Senior health officials have insisted the drugs have gone through a thorough quality and safety review process. Priority for vaccinations will be given to workers at quarantine hotels for return travellers, frontline health workers, and nursing home residents and staff. Australia has recorded 28,920 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began. 909 people have died, according to the health department. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Britain's departure from the European Union following months of negotiations has affected trade in many industries, but fishing has been hit especially hard by the breakdown known as Brexit. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports that some fishermen fear for their futures.
With Britain having broken away from the European Union, British fishermen say they are struggling to keep their businesses afloat.
We thought we was going to carry on after Brexit. The markets supposedly were sorted, and they've slammed the door in my buyer's face.
65-year-old Tim Hurd is an oyster fisherman in the waters by the town of Falmouth. He's been doing this for 50 years. He's part of a group of fishermen known as the Oystermen of Fowl, who for generations have been fishing these same southwestern waters. But today, he says, the fishing business here is struggling.
If I never had a bit of money in the bank and my wife wasn't working, I think we'd be out of an house, you know?
It's that serious since Brexit?
Yeah. There's people in here that turned to drink because of the strength of this. Don't know where to go, what to do, how to pay their bills.
The waters here are called Class B, meaning that shellfish must be purified before consumption. It also means, because of Brexit, the shellfish here can't be sold to the EU's 27-member bloc. That has Martin Laity, owner of Sailors Creek Shellfish, demanding action.
Get a move on. Sort it out. You know, get some stamina, get over to Europe, sort it out. You know, we want direct answers to direct questions.
The European Commission says the ban is for health reasons. Fishermen say it's impractical. Those like Hurd, who is due to retire this year, are calling on the government to take urgent action to lift the EU ban. The uncertain future, he says, means retirement may have to wait. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This is VOA. A Libyan official says the motorcade of the interior minister of the UN-backed government came under attack on Sunday in the capital, Tripoli. He says armed men opened fire on Fathi Bashagha's motorcade, wounding at least one of his guards. Bashagha survived the attack, and his guards chased the assailants, killing one and detaining two others. No group has claimed responsibility for the assault, which underscores the insecurity in the North African country. And the Australian Open of Tennis wrapped up this weekend. 23-year-old Naomi Osaka of Japan won the women's title over American Jennifer Brady. It's Osaka's fourth major title and her second in Melbourne. On the men's side, 33-year-old Serbian Novak Djokovic took the title, beating Russian up-and-comer Daniil Medvedev. The win in Melbourne is Djokovic's record 9th Australian Open victory and his 18th Grand Slam title. Djokovic is now just 2 major championships behind Roger Federer of Switzerland and Rafael Nadal of Spain, who are tied for the most men's tennis Grand Slam titles of all time, with 20 each.
In 1964, astronomers used a series of sounding rockets to study a source of powerful galactic X-rays. The origin of the X-rays was found in a binary system called Cygnus X-1, nearly 6,100 light-years away. The system contains what is considered to be the first black hole ever detected and its blue supergiant companion star. The stellar black hole was long thought to have a mass equal to about 14 suns. A recent study based on new observations and published in the journal Science suggests the black hole is more massive than thought, at 20 times that of the sun. The study also provided evidence the collapsed star that created the black hole once had a mass of 60 suns. Study researchers used the Very Long Baseline Array, a series of 10 radio telescope dishes spread across the United States. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Sunday marked 56 years since Malcolm X was gunned down in New York City. The famed black activist and civil rights leader was just 39 years old when he was assassinated while preparing to deliver a speech. Three members of the Nation of Islam were convicted in the 1965 shooting, but this weekend, members of X's family have released evidence that they say implicates the New York Police Department and the FBI in the killing. The family described a letter written by a deceased police officer stating that he had been pressured by his NYPD supervisors to lure two members of Malcolm X's security detail into committing crimes that resulted in their arrest just days before the fatal shooting. Those arrests kept the men from managing door security at X's speech and were part of a conspiracy between the NYPD and FBI to have him killed, according to the letter. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office has been reviewing the case and released a statement saying its, quote, review of this matter is active and ongoing, end quote. The NYPD said in a separate statement it has, quote, provided all available records relevant to that case to the district attorney, end quote, remains committed to assist with that review in any way, end quote. The FBI declined to comment. Before the family released the letter, VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Malcolm X's daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz, as part of a series of interviews for Black History Month. Shabazz is a professor, social activist, community organizer, and author. She spoke to Phillips about her father's legacy and what his activism means today. Here's a clip of their conversation.
Well, I don't think my father only belongs in a Black History Month story. My father is quoted 53.7 thousand times per hour in social media. And this is the clearest evidence that young people want to know who Malcolm is. They're looking for leaders who are wise and who speak truth that they can employ to meet systemic challenges head on. This is what they find in Malcolm. And this generation will have the capacity to recognize our collective humanity, not from a black and white perspective, but demanding change and willing to do the necessary work.
Of course, Malcolm X was not fighting only for the rights and dignity of African Americans, but for Africans wherever they lived, including the continent itself.
He traveled abroad in the 1950s and 60s and aligned with the Organization of African Unity, came back home and created the Organization of Afro-American Unity. He internationalized the struggle for Black people worldwide. He said that we all were going through the same thing no matter where we existed on Earth.
Your father was often considered radical compared to, say, Martin Luther King, whom some considered more of a gradualist.
He said, if you stick a knife in my back 9 inches and pull it out 6 inches, there's no progress. If you pull the knife all the way out, that's not progress. The progress is healing the wound wherever we find ourselves.
Malcolm X's fight for freedom was personal as well.
Oh, absolutely. Look, he grew up in the height of Jim Crow. My father's father was lynched by a mob of the KKK. Years later, his mother was put into an institution. Their land was taken. Their family was torn apart. And we see that this is something very consistent in South Africa with apartheid, in the Congo, in Ghana, in Nigeria, all across the land. Many people were lynched for no reason other than being Black, being brown, supporting equality. My father had a very profound reaction to that. And so he introduced a human rights agenda to the civil rights movement.
Your father famously said that he wanted to, quote, bring about the complete independence of people of African descent and bring about the freedom of these people by whatever means necessary. To many, that meant violence. Your response?
He was speaking to the continued injustices, the continued killings, the mass incarceration, the police brutality. But my father never advocated violence. He had a profound reaction to the violence that was happening to his people.
There was that famous photograph of him peering through his window holding a shotgun. What was the context for that?
His home had been firebombed. A firebomb was thrown into the nursery where his babies slept. And of course, if no one was coming to protect his home, he had to have a rifle to protect his family.
Your mother, Betty Shabazz, was his partner in the struggle, and you often sing her praises along with his.
My mom was just really incredible. You know, she was in her 20s, and she had 4 babies. She was pregnant with twins when her home was firebombed. 1 week later, her husband was assassinated in front of the family as he was delivering his Organization of Afro-American Unity. And she made sure that her 6 daughters were well-informed and had a really good sense of self, their identity. We learned about women's contribution to the world as we learned about Islam's contribution to the world. We learned that Africa is the cradle of the most advanced civilization ever to exist in mankind. The kingdoms of Futajela, Benin, Ghana, Mali, Egypt, if they got even half the attention that Greece and Rome do, then perhaps we Americans and the rest of the world might appreciate the present complexity of Black civilizations in Africa without learning hate and discrimination, but love and respect for ourselves and humanity.
I know that you're doing your very best to carry on their legacy in your own way with books about your father and mother, especially for children.
Absolutely. My premise is we need a better education curriculum. And honestly, I want Black children especially, but all children ultimately, to open up a book and see a reflection of themselves. I believe that every child deserves an opportunity to know that they are worthy of love, that they are worthy of a quality education, and that they're worthy of participating in mainstream society if they so desire.
That was Ilyasa Shabazz, a social activist, community organizer, and author. She is also an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. Shabazz is a daughter of Malcolm X and was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Authorities say a 95-year-old former Nazi concentration camp guard has been deported from the United States to his native Germany, where he was being held by police for questioning. The AP's Julie Walker reports.
Frederick Karl Berger arrived Saturday, according to German authorities. Until then, he'd been living in Tennessee. The U.S. Justice Department says Berger admitted to being a guard at a Nazi concentration subcamp and is still receiving a pension for his work. In recent years, German prosecutors have successfully argued that by helping a death camp or a concentration camp function, guards can be found guilty of accessory to murder. The Justice Department says Berger is the 70th Nazi persecutor removed from the United States. I'm Julie Walker.
London was never on Hong Konger Aragorn's wish list of places to visit, but now the 36-year-old, who goes by a pseudonym, is trying to build a new life in the British capital after fleeing a security clampdown in his birthplace. He is one of thousands trying to flee Hong Kong and settle in Britain, Gloria So of Reuters reports.
London is one of the last places 36-year-old Aragorn ever thought he would visit. But now, the Hong Konger and pro-democracy activist has been forced to build a new life in the British capital after he fled China's security crackdown on his home city.
Yeah, I can't say we are either betraying or not betraying the cause of, like, fighting for our own rights and fighting for democracy. But I think you have to keep living. I mean, at least you have to stay alive for any cause.
Aragorn, who did not want to give his full name out of fear for his safety, is not alone. Nearly 5,000 Hong Kong citizens have already applied to live and work in Britain under a new visa scheme which affords Hong Kongers an expedited path to British citizenship. Britain launched the scheme for holders of a special British national overseas passport after Beijing imposed a sweeping national security law on Hong Kong. Activists say the law erodes the freedoms promised to the former British colony when it was returned to Chinese rule. But while the scheme makes it easier for Hong Kongers to emigrate to Britain, the struggle of settling into an unfamiliar place still remains.
I shouldn't be that optimistic, and that's why I start looking for, like, waiter jobs or even kitchen assistant job in restaurants or, like, bubble tea shop store assistant or whatever.
The new visa scheme could bring over 300,000 Hong Kongers and their dependents to Britain in the next 5 years. Hong Kong residents who qualify for the scheme will be allowed to stay in Britain for 5 years and then apply for settled status and citizenship. In total, some 5.4 million Hong Kongers could ultimately be eligible.
That was Gloria So of Reuters. Now for some music. Stanza Muvandimwe is a breakthrough artist from Kigali, Rwanda. His new self-produced music video is called Vumilia. That's a Kiswahili word for persevere. He says the song encourages all to remain calm and strong during these terrible times of COVID-19. That was Stanza Muvandimwe's new song Vumilia, which is Kiswahili for persevere. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Tracy Carter, and our editor, Bill Eagle, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
One of the tough questions facing the administration of Joe Biden is how to deal with Venezuela's illegitimate Maduro government and the humanitarian crisis caused by the repression and corruption of Nicolas Maduro and his cohorts. The overriding goal of the Biden-Harris administration is to support a peaceful democratic transition in Venezuela through free and fair presidential and parliamentary elections and to help the Venezuelan people rebuild their lives and country, said State Department spokesperson Ned Price.
Venezuelans have a right to democracy and a government that promotes and defends it, just like everyone else in this hemisphere. President Biden, you have heard him say this even before he was elected President Biden. He understands the pain that the current crisis in Venezuela has inflicted on the people of Venezuela and their families. Again, Maduro is a dictator. His repression, corruption, and mismanagement have created one of the most dire humanitarian crises this hemisphere has seen.
Spokesperson Price noted that in dealing with Venezuela, the Biden administration will follow four basic principles.
One, designating as appropriate Venezuela for temporary protected status. Number two, addressing the humanitarian concerns of millions of Venezuelans with international partners. Number three, targeting regime officials and their cronies involved in corruption and human rights abuses. And number four, again, aiding and restoring a peaceful, stable, democratic future for Venezuelans and the regime, both through free and fair elections and a long-term economic recovery.
Nicolas Maduro is a dictator. There's no doubt about that, said spokesperson Price, adding that he does not expect this administration to be engaging directly with Maduro. Instead, he said the United States will work through allies and partners.
We will do that with our partners in the region. We will do that with our European partners and allies. We'll do that with the OAS. We will do that through the Lima Group, through a number of fora, like-minded fora, that share the same goals of bringing about democracy and human rights and an end to this corrupt dictatorship in Venezuela.
The United States continues to recognize the 2015 National Assembly as the last remaining democratic institution in Venezuela, said spokesperson Price. And consistent with that, the person chosen by the National Assembly to be its president as the interim president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido. That was